Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Association for Multicultural Concerns Luncheon. My name is Don Brown, and I'll be speaking to you a bit later. Just wanted to welcome you and let you know that the program will get underway shortly. Hope you enjoy your meal, and we'll talk to you in a minute. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. All right. So I'm going to bring the mic around and just introduce yourself. Self-introduction, so everybody have an idea who's here and whatnot. Okay, so first of all, myself, I'm Foster Brown.
I'm Lillian Scafey, president.
All right, Lillian. Introduce
yourself. I'm Don Brown.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Bernice Kandarian, Mountain View, California.
Roger Peterson, Mountain View, California, second vice president of CCB.
Good afternoon. Teddy Joy Remhild from the Glendale Burbank chapter.
Glendale, SoCal, I miss y'all.
Lorraine Theveny from Redwood Chapter, first-timer.
First-timer, woo! Get that first-timer here!
Thank you. Richard Retha, Union City, but they'll vote Dodger fan.
Dodger fan, that's right. LA represent. Yeah. Represent.
Even though I moved to the Bay Area, I'm still a Laker fan, so.
I'm Joseph Lopez from Santa Barbara, and I'm a member of the San Diego Braille Club.
All right. Just introduce yourself real quick. What's your name?
Yeah. My name is Jeff Bilek. I'm from Reading.
All right, Jeff. Pleasure to have you here. Kevin?
Kevin Berkery from Burbank, California.
Right.
And a Lakers fan.
Artis Bazin, president of the Glendale Burbank chapter.
All right.
Donna Pomerantz, CCB president from Pasadena.
Mitch Pomerantz from Everywhere and USC Forever.
I can't match that. Tammy Stevens from Yosemite Gateway Council in Merced.
Linda O'Neill from Sacramento, ACB Capital Chapter.
Frank Welty from the San Francisco Chapter and the Contra Costa Chapter.
Vita Zavali with the San Francisco and Contra Costa Chapters.
All righty, Vita. Vita Loca.
Hello, my name is Juliana Harris. I'm the vice president of the Humboldt Council for the Blind, and this is my first time here. I'm a greenhorn.
James Chamberlain, Glendale, Burbank.
All right, James.
Anthony Signorello, Glendale, Burbank chapter.
Charles Navarrete, East LA.
Thank you. Gail Crossan, La Habra, is residence and Orange County chapter.
All right, Orange County.
Charlene Ornelas, San Diego Braille Club.
All right.
Okay, that's introductions.
Introduce.
Okay, so let's get started here. All right, so let's see. So I'm going to introduce our speaker for this luncheon. Don Brown has over 20 years of experience in the areas of human resource administration and disability programs management. He holds a bachelor's degree in clinical psychology from San Francisco State University and a human resources study certificate from Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Don is certified as both an alternative dispute resolution specialist and an Americans with Diabetes Act trainer. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm blind. I'm sorry. We're among friends. Hey, righty. Yes, yes. And I'm sorry, Americans with Disabilities Act trainer with both the U.S. Department of Justice and U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I might need to call you now. No. Mr. Brown is the CEO of Access Work Systems, a disability programs management counseling firm, which he founded in 2000. For the past 12 years, Don has consulted as an expert witness in employment cases specializing in the reasonable accommodations process. As a private job placement specialist, a human resources professional, and a person with a disability, Don brings a unique hands-on perspective to the fast-changing and increasingly complex area of employment and disability. Okay, let's see here. All right. Don Brown is currently employed as an ADA compliance specialist with the City of Berkeley. Is that it? That's it. All right, and with no further ado, I present to you Mr. Don Brown.
Please, thank you. Thank you very much, Foster, and good afternoon, everyone. I'll try to speak as loudly as I can, although I've not been accused of not being able to do that. When I hear my bio and I have 20 years of experience, I think, oh, God. I started at 6 years old. I started this stuff. Well, I do need to emphasize, by way of full disclosure, my experience is in the area of compliance and enforcement. So I don't bring a theoretical approach to the ADA. I think I bring a practical, hands-on approach to the topic. Someone asked me earlier today, or commented, that the topic today, the ADA, what's in blind people, is kind of presumptuous. She said perhaps the topic should be, is there anything in it for blind people? So I'll answer that question. I'll say, yes, there are provisions in the ADA that are specific to people who are blind and visually impaired, and we'll talk a bit about that today. What I won't do today, I won't talk about the ongoing discussion with respect to the definition of disability, which is constantly changing. I think we can all stipulate that people who are blind and visually impaired would be covered under the ADA for all intents and purposes. So we won't talk about that very much. What we'll focus on is the titles where I think provisions specific to blind people can be found. So we'll look specifically at Title I, which are the employment provisions. We'll look at Title II, which are programs of state and local governments. And we'll look at Title III, which are public accommodations. And I'd like to start with Title III, actually. When we talk about public accommodations, we're talking about privately owned entities who provide goods and services to the public. So we're talking about grocery stores, we're talking about theaters, we're talking about museums, entertainment parks, any place individuals might go where goods and services are provided. So what's in it for blind people with respect to public accommodations? Obviously, there's a topic that's being discussed now that was part of a program this morning, which I missed, and I hope that I can hear it on the streaming repeat, having to do with prescription medications. What we know with respect to the ADA, in Title III, entities are required to provide auxiliary aids and services to people with disabilities so that the goods and services are made accessible. Now, when we talk about auxiliary aids and services, what does that mean? It means that these entities, grocery stores, pharmacies, et cetera, must ensure that their products are accessible, and they can do that by providing some type of assistance, or what we call in Title I, they can provide a reasonable accommodation. Except in Title III, it's called the provision of auxiliary aids and services. So when we look at the issue of accessible prescriptions, that is a textbook example of an auxiliary aid and service. What we know is that pharmacies provide prescriptions generally in print. And if we were to interpret the ADA correctly, we would know that those pharmacies are required to make sure that service they're providing is accessible to people with disabilities. So how do they do that with respect to people who are blind and vision impaired? We don't have to figure this out. Our attorneys, Lainey and Linda and other folks, have already figured it out. They make that piece accessible or that service accessible by providing the information regarding prescriptions in a way that people who are blind and vision impaired can have access to. And in this case, it's talking. We have an audio output for prescription medication. So again, an example of an auxiliary aid or service, and in this case would be an aid because the prescription bottle now talks, so that is the aid. To ensure that process or service is accessible. So that's one example of how Title III entities are required to make their goods and services accessible. Now, what we get confused about when we talk about Title III, I often get calls from people saying, I just bought a stereo, and there's no buttons, there's no way of me to discern how to turn on the CD player, et cetera, et cetera. Don, this must be made accessible under the ADA. Sony is completely out of compliance. Yeah, blah, blah. Not true. Not the case. Unfortunately, the ADA doesn't require manufacturers to make their products accessible. Although there's discussions underway which may change that stance today, that's not the case. What the ADA does require is where those products are sold must be accessible, right? So it's often it's a major misconception that products must be made accessible. We may see some, as I said, some change in that area in the near future. Another example of a Title III entity, a grocery store or a department store, making sure its goods and services are accessible to people who are blind and vision impaired, would be to assist people with shopping. We've all gone into our local grocery store, and they pair you up with a person to shop with you. Now, when we talk about accommodations or auxiliary aids and services, one thing we have to keep in mind, whatever service is provided to accommodate the individual must be effective. That's a key concept. I had a situation I was involved with my local grocery store, and this grocery store has a history of hiring persons with developmental disabilities, which we all support. The issue that I had is that oftentimes I would be matched with a person with a developmental disability to shop, and there were some difficulties with respect to being able to effectively communicate with that individual. While the entity was providing an accommodation, it was not an effective accommodation. And so keep that in mind when you're in a store and they say, okay, this person will shop with you. If you're not able to handle your business or do your shopping in an effective way, then there are some questions with respect to the veracity of that particular accommodation. And that's some issue that you can raise. And speaking of raising the issue, this is where I think a lot of people with these have some difficulty. The ADA, unfortunately, was framed as a voluntary compliance concept was attached to the ADA. And I think we can safely say the ADA is the only piece of civil rights legislation which was voluntary with respect to complying. If we were to look back at programs coming out of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which spoke specifically to people of color and women, those programs weren't voluntary. They were mandatory that entities were to comply. So I think some of the disillusion around the ADA is directly linked to the fact that it's a voluntary compliance piece of legislation. So I think that's an important preface to have when we look at the ADA. So the other piece of this is it takes a great deal of advocacy to challenge some of the discrimination that occur. For example, the instance that I recounted with respect to the person shopping with me and not being able to effectively do that, what that requires is, A, me going to talk with the manager, me being clear about what the expectation is and what the requirements are of that particular entity, and following through. And sometimes that's difficult. Either people don't have enough time, they may not feel comfortable, they may feel that it results in an adversarial relationship, and because of that, you know, we may say, oh, forget it, maybe next time I'll have a better experience. So I understand that. I understand the hesitancy with respect to pursuing potential violations under the ADA, because oftentimes it takes a great deal of energy and time to do so, but it's absolutely critical that we do it. And we'll come back to Title III as well. I'm looking forward to a lot of your questions as well. Title II is an interesting piece because it concerns itself with programs of state and local governments, your state, your county, your city, et cetera. So what's in it for blind people on that level? What we know is that these entities, state and local governments, must make their programs accessible to people with disabilities. Right? So specifically for blind people as an example, and as well, I should say, that these entities are required to effectively communicate, meaning they must communicate with people with disabilities on the same level they communicate with persons who do not have disabilities. So for people who are blind and visually impaired, what that means is alternate formats for the most part. So it is definitely required, for example, that a city, if requested, must provide to individuals blind and vision impaired information, let's say regarding their city council meeting. If you're interested in the agenda of the city council meeting, that information must be provided to you in an accessible format. If you're interested in taking advantage of some program, let's say a swimming program offered by your city, the eligibility requirements for that program must not be discriminatory, and you must be providing an accommodation so that you may participate in that particular program. Again, that doesn't always happen. I know that because even in my job as of today, we still see some of our departments and divisions coming up with eligibility criteria that they chose to not run past us that can be discriminatory. And then as compliance people, we have to sit down with them and say, hey, you can't do this, and then the fight starts at that point. But these entities are required to effectively communicate with you. And that can range from, as I said, information about your taxes, if you're being charged for your garbage pickup and you're being billed through the city, those bills must be made accessible to you, the statements must be made accessible to you, et cetera. And what we see on the level of Title II entities, we're seeing more and more cities and counties moving to online services. And we're doing that with the city of Berkeley right now with a great deal of discussion. And what we know is, again, these services must be made accessible as well. And a number of cities haven't thought about how do we make this online application accessible to people with disabilities. So it's not uncommon for you to find that your city or your county has a range of online services that may, in fact, not be accessible to people who are blind and vision impaired. So what do you do if that were to happen? First thing that you would do is do your homework. Find out whether or not the city has a grievance procedure, has some type of complaint process, and familiarize yourself with that complaint process. And then start with the department or division in charge of whatever problem you're facing. And obviously, the best rule of thumb is to try to resolve things on the lowest level. It's faster. But sometimes that's not the case. They may say, oh, well, you know, you're the only person who's complained about this, so therefore this is not an issue. So then you elevate it. Whatever your structure is, you elevate that. And should it not be resolved, then you can file a complaint. And when you file a complaint against a Title II entity, that complaint is filed with the U.S. Department of Justice if we're talking about an ADA violation. Yes, it's true. As I said, in part of my full disclosure, I'm about the practical hands-on approach. So if I suggest to you that you can file a complaint with the Department of Justice, I have to quickly follow that up with the Department of Justice has about a 3-year log on investigating complaints, which is another reason why people oftentimes choose not to pursue the complaint process. And that's unfortunate, and hopefully that can be an advocacy issue that disability groups can work on to ensure that these type of complaints are looked at in a timely fashion. There are some other provisions that are applicable to people who are blind and vision impaired in Title II, and that has to do with employment. Employment in state and local governments. Employment is covered under Title II as well as Title I, but Title II specifically, meaning that the entity cannot discriminate in an employment context based on disability, means that the employer must communicate with an applicant with a disability in an effective manner. And again, for people who are blind and vision impaired, that could very well mean alternate formats or having some means of access to employment announcements, employment applications, or any other materials related to the employment selection process. Now, again, what we're seeing, the trend is that these entities are moving more toward online selection. And as with the online applications, we are finding that many employers' online employment selection processes have some difficulties or inaccessible issues as it relates to people who are blind and vision impaired. Again, the same rule of thumb applies if you encounter that. And if you have the energy or the inclination, I would encourage you to pursue a complaint if that needs to happen. Obviously, again, try to work with the entity to see whether or not there's some middle ground you might be able to reach. But should you not be successful, you certainly can file a complaint. In this case, if you were to file an employment complaint, that complaint would be filed with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or with your state, in the state of California, Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Again, these complaint processes are lengthy. If you look at the numbers in terms of resolution to these complaints, you would find that it's, I think, rare is an accurate word to use. It's rare that employees or applicants are found to be victorious in these type of complaints. And I don't think that's because these agencies discriminate with respect to investigating these complaints. I think it's because persons who file these complaints are not very knowledgeable about the complaint process. And keeping in mind that these complaints are reviewed by bureaucrats who are used to specific language, and if that specific language is not used, that could adversely impact the veracity of the complaint. That's unfortunate. So I don't think that EEOC or DFEH, in our case in California, has a game plan to systematically discriminate in the complaint process. But what we do know is that those organizations really don't put a lot of energy into educating charging parties with respect to how to effectively communicate their complaint. And interestingly enough, with respect to both of these agencies, when you file your complaint, there's a line or two lines: please describe your complaint, right? And those two lines are critical, because that is what the charge will be measured by: how you describe the circumstances that led to the alleged discrimination. So it's critical in that case to ensure that the words are there, the buzzwords are used, the terminology, even citations of particular provisions are incorporated. And you might ask, well, how would the layperson know this, or how would the layperson pursue this type of a detailed complaint? And the unfortunate response to that is most lay people don't have that experience, and thus the high rate of denial of claims with respect to people who are disabled, unfortunately. Let's talk a little bit about Title I. Title I is focused primarily on employment. And again, it mirrors Title II with respect to what the employer is required to do. And the news in these areas, as I mentioned before, is the technology. The technology that is being incorporated in these processes. I receive calls from people saying, oh, I just submitted my application online. I didn't get a confirmation. I don't even know if they received it. There's no name of a person I can follow up with, et cetera. And while the ADA doesn't speak to the availability of HR staff to communicate with you, the ADA certainly does speak to whether or not that process you're engaging in is in fact accessible. And again, you shouldn't be surprised to learn that many employers are finding themselves behind the ball with respect to making sure that these online processes are accessible. And you know, the age-old question comes up when we talk about Title I disclosing disability. We can see on applications, is it illegal to ask, do you have a disability on an application? It's not illegal to ask that. It's illegal to demand an answer to it. Many employers will ask about disability and race and gender in a particular area of an application, and theoretically, and that of information is removed from the application before it's reviewed by an analyst. And a job that I had a number of years ago, I know that was a case because that was my job, actually, tearing off that piece. When I worked in EEO, and we would use that information in the EEO process to have a sense of our applicant pool, have a sense of how effective our recruitment outreach efforts are, et cetera. And it's in that case, the information with respect to disclosing race, disability, gender, et cetera, was not factored in to the selection process. So it's not uncommon to see on an application question about gender or disability. What you should see in that same area is this information is voluntary. So you can choose to disclose or choose not to. So it's often asked, so what's the downside to disclosing? in advance. And, you know, we, especially people who worked in employment placement, et cetera, we all have our answers to that question. But I think at the end of the day, it depends. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer with respect to disclosing in advance. I can tell you this. When I was at San Francisco State, I was having drinks with a bunch of folks in our HR department, and I asked that question. I said, you know, would you prefer to know in advance that the next person you'll be interviewing is a person with a disability? And all of them said yes. And then my follow-up question is, if you didn't know that and the person showed up, what's your reaction to that? And you know, most of them said, you know, I would feel that this person hadn't been honest with me. Et cetera. So if you have that analyst going into the process thinking that this candidate in front of them has not been honest, we can assume that that may not, you know, be the best way to enter a selection process for the candidate. So those are realities that are out there, and I don't have the answer to it. I know obviously training is a piece of it. We certainly want to work with persons who are involved in the selection process in providing them with information about people with disabilities, providing them with information with respect to etiquette, providing them with information with respect to what is reasonable as we look at the applicant and candidate process. But training is not the end all. It's really not. I've done hours of stand-up training in front of people, and my view on it is if one person in the room learned something, then I think it was a success. But to think that the entire room heard Don Brown for the last 3 hours and they're going to go out there with changed attitudes, I would like to think that in my ego-driven moments I do think that. But in reality, it doesn't happen. We know, folks in HR, we know how effective training is or isn't. And even in that area, we're seeing some changes in terms of how these managers are being trained. Rather than waste their time and have Don Brown talk with them for 2 hours, we're developing computer-based training where they can sit at their desk, hit a button, and do a 20-minute course on whatever topic, reasonable accommodation. And after that 20 minutes, they may be given 10 multiple choice questions. If they miss more than 5, a pop-up comes on their screen. Call Don Brown. and I will get their results as well on my computer, so I know exactly what to talk with them about. So we're looking at different ways of targeting training, and we may be more effective that way in terms of changing attitudes. I remember years ago I had a supervisor who told me training is not about changing attitudes. Training is about changing behaviors. And she said, we don't care what your attitude is, but at work you will behave like this. So you know, I keep that in mind when I train. It's about behaviors, not so much about attitude. And hopefully, once you change behaviors, attitudes then follow. So that's what we bank on in that regard. But in general, because I'm interested if you might have any questions, I would say that, yes, there's a great deal in the ADA that's applicable to people who are blind and vision impaired. It requires us to, A, know what the provisions are, B, know how to advocate for ourselves, and C, be persistent. And I know under certain circumstances, those three pieces are complicated and sometimes not very attractive to engage. So, yes?
Mitch.
Hey, Mitch.
It's wonderful. For those who don't know, Don and I, except I retired before he did, I was ADA compliant in the city of LA for 15 years, 14 years. And I like your comments on disclosure because I was on the other side of the interview table and I got my surprises.
Yes.
And if you don't disclose disability, they're not going to accommodate.
That's true. That's true. And again, and during that disclosure process in the exam area, that information is to be kept separate as well. Now, how entities do that is challenging, obviously. But if you are requiring an accommodation in an exam process, you're right. You are, in fact, disclosing.
Department of Justice is looking for high impact cases. Mm-hmm. They're looking for cases that they can use to make precedent. And for that reason, when folks ask me about filing with the Department of Justice, my normal comment is don't. I don't know if fair employment and housing is any better.
It's not.
But I really got to tell you that unless you think you have a case that's going to impact every blind person, you're probably better advised to go a different direction other than going to the Department of Justice.
And that's a very good point. And I think along those, what a lot of people don't understand is in the state of California, you cannot pursue legal action against an employer unless you first go through either the Department of Fair Employment and Housing or the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Now, what you can do is go to both of those entities and go, hey, here's my complaint, issue me a right to sue. And they'll issue you a right to sue saying that we have not looked at this complaint, we have not determined whether this complaint has merit or not. And then at that point, you can pursue an attorney. I think what we're missing with respect to enforcement and compliance, we're missing a middle ground. And we're missing, and that middle ground, in my view, are professional advocates. Most attorneys won't take ADA cases because there's very little money in them. Most charging parties don't have the content knowledge to represent themselves. So there's very few options. So I think what's missing, and for people in this room who have expertise in particular areas, especially ADA, disability enforcement, et cetera, professional advocates, I think, is a way to go. Professional advocates obviously are not loved by attorneys, nor can professional advocates provide legal information or legal advice. But an advocate can make those phone calls, can write those letters for you, can push the envelope with the city or with an employer, et cetera. I just had a case a few weeks ago, a blind woman losing her vision, RN, with one of the largest nonprofit health organizations in the state. Starts with a K. and she was an effective nurse for 20 years. She knew 5 years ago that she would be experiencing a vision loss, and she made a decision to transition from bedside nursing to more administrative or on-phone type nursing. A new supervisor came on the scene. Always danger when new supervisors come on the scene. If you're a person with a disability, oh my God, what are they going to do? And when that supervisor came on the scene, the first day there was a code called, and code, you know, ding ding, code. Everybody runs to the person and the sick person. And this nurse, visually impaired nurse, ran sick person, was the only nurse available, and she conducted the examination, made a determination that the patient, you know, needed X, Y, and Z. And later the supervisor asked her how did you know that this person's skin wasn't warm or wasn't cold? She said, well, I touched him. And, you know, how did you know that this person accepted? So basically her competencies were being questioned. And she ended up in a meeting a week later being asked some very pointed questions. And her job duties were subsequently restricted to have no patient contact. So yes, I would, you know, just looking on the face of it, it appeared to me that the employer may have rushed to judgment. But then, Mitch and I know, being on the other side of the desk, we would say, well, you know, this patient, this employer is concerned about liability and needs to make sure whether or not health professionals are, you know, make sure that this person's disability is not adversely impacting her ability to provide quality health care. So there is a balancing act. And I can tell you that health organization's legal team, they can't sleep at night, I'm sure, knowing that there's a legally blind nurse in the hospital, right? So they're very concerned about liability, about safety. However, this individual, she went to an attorney, and the attorney basically said, well, come back to me once you receive a termination note. Because they haven't terminated you, there's really little that we can do. So that's why I think there needs to be some middle ground. This employee obviously needed some support. This employee obviously needed some advice with respect to how to interact with this new manager, needed something in writing to clarify what her abilities are, et cetera, et cetera. She was even asking, you know, hey, when a patient returns medication, how do you know that's morphine in the bottle, right? I can't imagine you never being president, though. Is that really going to happen? Question. Sure. Hi, Vita. Mm. Oh my gosh.
I'm just curious to know, do guide dogs fall under ADA?
Absolutely.
Or is it separate regulation? Because if ADA is voluntary, does that mean an employer can actually, you know, tell you that your guide dog can't be there for some reason, like if you work in a hospital or, you know?
Right. Good question. And when I say voluntary, it doesn't mean that the employer has a choice to comply. It means that there's not a foot on its neck to do so. And when issues come up of a violation, yes, that employer would be held liable, you know, responsible should it be found in the employee's favor. So voluntary compliance only means that there's not an assertive effort to make compliance occur within a specific time frame. And one could argue that is, oh, Donna, the ADA, everything should have been implemented by, March 21st of 1993, is it? Surprise, hello. Okay, but to answer your question with respect to service animals, yes, service animals are, in fact, covered under the ADA. And what's difficult about this discussion, and we spend a lot of time on this at work, is because remember when the ADA first came out and there was a definition of service animal? And remember the definition was any animal, any animal individually. Okay, so a lot of states signed on to that and said, okay, yes, we want that as our definition as well, right? So now that it's been changed to say that dogs, any dog, individually trained and in small type horses, service horses, but primarily any dog individually trained, that changed on the federal level. The difficulty is it didn't change on the state level. Right? So, and keep in mind the ADA indicates that any state that provides a greater degree of protection than that state law would supersede the ADA. And in the state of California, it's argued that since we do not restrict service animals to dogs, then we are providing a greater level of protection. So then that gets us into the issue of assistance animals, companion animals, etc. But to answer your question directly, Vita, yes, service animals are covered under the ADA as well as state law, and employers cannot discriminate based on that. Now, there are some defenses that employers have with respect to service animals. Service animals they can prevent service animals from entering areas that may be of some danger, whether it's some type of electrical area or welding area, et cetera. And then, of course, we know about the limitations in hospitals, et cetera. But there's very few defenses with respect to preventing service animals from entering work settings. But yes, sure. Right. That is a defense. That is a defense. Not only do employers have that defense, but Title III entities as well. In fact, in the question and answer information put out by the Department of Justice, one of the examples of a disruptive service animal involves a movie theater. If we're in a movie theater and there is a dog that's excessively barking, is that considered disruptive? And obviously, when we conduct the analysis to determine disruption, we have to look at the nature of the business. So the nature of a movie theater is people are, you know, watching and listening to a movie, and if a dog is barking, I think we can safely say, yes, that's disruptive. But let me just one quick follow-up on that. So if a service animal is disruptive or somehow presents a hazard, whether it's a hygiene issue, the entity can ask the animal to leave the premises, but still must provide the service to the individual. Without their services. Wait on to tie your dog up outside and we'll help you out here. Vita, go ahead.
I wanted to make a comment.
Yes.
I'm the ADA coordinator for the San Diego Fair. Ah. What we do is I tell people, if a person would have that same type of behavior, would you ask them to leave? And the answer is yes.
Yes. And frankly, I have sat next to people barking in movie theaters, so I completely support the analysis. It's a different disability. Okay. Right? It's a good point. And you know, along the defenses and that service animal folks should keep in mind has to do with hygiene. If an entity can make an argument that the dog presents a hazard because of, I was going to say something gross, but we're eating, because of hygiene issues, then that may be a defense for that entity. Yes, sure.
When mm-hmm. Is that the way to go to try to get, if you had a violation,
I think so. As Mitch pointed out, and he's absolutely right, DOJ is looking for high-impact cases. So if there is a situation that you know adversely impacts a number of people who are blind and vision impaired, and I do think class action suits or group actions are more effective than individual actions. We're seeing that with our structured negotiation involvement. And I think that whole process is predicated on the notion that a number of people are adversely impacted. So I would say yes to your question.
Can I ask that question?
Sure.
I'm interested in the possibility of
theaters, you said? Oh, yes. Lainey Feingold, Linda Dardarian.
Mm-hmm. She filed a contract against Cinemark.
Mm-hmm.
To
Right.
And we have done our due diligence. We have offered to offset the cost.
Wow.
To install the devices.
Uh-huh.
And that has never ever ended up going anywhere.
Mm.
And we just need to know our next step. We just hope to that it's just too small. Our theaters are enough for us to get a lawyer to support a student.
You know, it gets us back to defenses. Entities can't have a defense based on revenues, based on other financial considerations, based on technical feasibility, et cetera. So when we talk about entities must make their goods and services accessible to people with disabilities, if we were to read the next line of that is unless to do so presents, you know, a financial undue burden or is duly disruptive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there are some defenses that are related to revenue. Now, when renovations occur, then that kind of shifts us into the discussion of physical access as well as signage, which is another area of the... Oh. Wow. Well, you are on top of it. Good for you. Well, I would encourage you to cost out those numbers. If you can, you have. Then here's a microphone. You're amazing. This is great. That's one of the advocates, the professional advocates. Have you sat down with the theater people? I'm sure you have. What's their bottom line? I like this woman.
And from what we understand is that they're planning on installing them, but they haven't made any effort to let us know, and they're skating our call.
Yeah.
They're tired of hearing from us, and so we're beginning to lose hope that we can actually
make them. Well, I would encourage you to not lose hope. Sometimes the entities don't want to give you specific dates and times in case they can't meet those deadlines. And if they don't meet the deadline here, I have to deal with you again saying I didn't meet the deadline. So, wow. I think you're asking for legal advice, which Mitch may have a response to that. Yeah. Oh. Well, is that financial, that revenue piece that it's hard for you as a consumer to make a cogent argument around because you don't have the numbers or you don't have access to all of the finances around the decision. But I would encourage you to keep drilling down to get as much information as possible. I think when you mentioned talking to the manufacturers, I think that's a good idea to get a sense of. They may not be able to tell you specifically about their customer, but you can ask them in general, what are the difficulties? What are the technical feasibility issues with respect to incorporating into a theater like this? That's my understanding. I would encourage you, and I am sure that everyone in this room will help you on this. Talk to Lainey and Linda again, and I'd be willing to talk with them too, just to have them again to look more closely at the situation in Humboldt, and see if there's anything that they might be able to do, anything from a scary letter to the movie theater or something. There must be some way to push the envelope, and. Well, I'm from Berkeley, so you know I'm down with that. Okay, you want to shoot real close. Okay. Well, maybe you can help with the letter writing campaign that we in CCB can get involved with, or something, or letters to the editor, somehow put some pressure. On that theater, we know that businesses do not like bad press. So if you're interested in spearheading an effort among CCB members for us to all write a short letter, and to the newspaper or wherever, I certainly be willing to do that. I'm sure other people in this room would be as well. We have Foster is hitting me here. He told me we have time for two more questions. Yes, Roger. Go good.
I'm really curious. At the beginning you said sometimes blind people said, "Is there anything that it does?" What is the problem? What is the problem with blind people's perception of the ADA not useful?
Well, that's a good question, and I do think there's some historical reality involved in that assumption. When we look at when the ADA was being crafted back in the day, absolutely. So we as blind folks, we didn't have a full chair at the table, unfortunately, and I think to this day, there's still some hangover from that. We know that the persons in the independent living movement were in the forefront of drafting language with respect to the ADA. And we, as blind people, I don't think any fault of our own, but we didn't engage the process in a way that would ensure that we would have a more central presence in the ADA. So you get it, right? You get it. So I think Roger, some of that hangover from the late 80s, I think it still exists. So I think a lot of blind people think, this is for people with disabilities, physical disabilities, and not for us. But hopefully that's changing. One more question, and it's a good point. And sometimes that may mean just going to a store manager or an airline staff person and saying, I just need to let you know, what you're doing is probably in violation of federal law. You know, just to get it on the radar screen, I agree with you. I think we do need to step up a bit. And when I say that, then I go reflexively back to I understand why people don't as well. But I do think it's in our best interest to do so. So with that, I will hand the microphone back to Mr. Brown here.
Thank you, Don. To the lady from Humboldt, also, have you spoken with, has your group, like, spoken with your congressperson? Because they may be able to assist you with putting some heat on the theater as well. That's what your congresspeople are for.
Make them work.
Yeah. Tell them you're not going to vote for them again if they don't. No, but I'm serious. Yeah, check them out, and they may help you with that.